Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Francine Prose, whose new book is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. We'll also hear from Edmund White, whose new memoir is Inside a Pearl, My Paris Years. And I'll review the new anthology by Garrison Keillor, The Keillor Reader. Francine Prose is one of our most distinguished American writers, the author of some 20 works of fiction, including My New American Life, A Changed Man, Blue Angel, and such well-known works of nonfiction as Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and Reading Like a Writer. She's a former president of Pan American Center and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She's joining us today to talk about her amazing new novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Francine Prose, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Lovers at the Chameleon Club was inspired by a very famous photograph by Brassai. Could you describe that photograph for us?
Sure. It's a photo, and, you know, I'd known this photo for a long time. I'd seen it before. It's a photo of two women sitting in a bar in 1932, and they're obviously a couple. One of the women is wearing a very pretty, spangly evening dress, and the other woman is dressed as a man. She's wearing a tuxedo and has a pinky ring and a kind of butch haircut. And she's quite broad-shouldered and tough-looking. And as I said, I knew this photo. I had no idea really who these people were. And I went to an exhibit, a Brassai show, at the National Gallery in Washington. And there was a little wall text. And all it said was that the woman in the tuxedo was a woman named Villette Morris who had worked for the Germans during the German occupation of Paris. And she'd been assassinated by the resistance in 1944. And I thought, whoa. So I went home, and, you know, it's the internet. I can find out a lot of things quick. And sure enough, it turned out that the real-life woman in the photograph had been a French auto racer and an athlete, a professional athlete. She'd been a shot putter, an Olympic hopeful. And in 1935, the French government had taken away her license to compete professionally as an athlete because she was a cross-dresser. And she was, you know, on a morals charge, basically. And in 1936, Hitler somehow found out about this fact and invited her to be his special guest at the Berlin Olympics. Now, I mean, everyone knows that Hitler was notoriously, viciously hostile to homosexuals. But in this case, he understood correctly that she had this huge network of contacts throughout France because there were all these local sports associations, women's sports associations. So she knew people in these associations all over France. So he hired her basically to be a spy. And she was able to say, you know, there's a troop movement, arms are being shipped, there's this and that, because she would travel around and give these lectures at these sports clubs. So she was the person who told the Germans where the Maginot Line ended, and so they could invade France in 1940. And then she went to work for the Gestapo as a torturer, basically, and then she was assassinated by the resistance in 1944. And when I heard this story, you know, fiction writers say, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, you couldn't make that story up. And I thought, well, it's so implausible that no one will believe it. I have to write it as nonfiction. And then early in the process, I thought, it would be so much more fun to write it as a novel. And that's what I did.
Well, you could tell it was fun to write, I think.
It was fun to write. I mean, writing the Berlin Olympics from the point of view of a furious French auto racer suddenly being treated in this marvelous way, having dinner with Hitler, who treated her very well, was a shocking amount of fun. And then, you know, immersing myself in Paris in the 20s, the world of luxury automobiles, athletics, art and the literature of the period. It was very, very enjoyable, although difficult. It was a hard book to write.
Well, there is this moment where Lionel Main, who is one of the writer characters, I think, says of Lou, she had balls as big as Hemingway's, bigger. And I could just imagine you writing that and laughing out loud.
It made me so happy.
See?
It made me so happy finally to be able to say something like that. And then to write the Lionel Main character, you know, because he's very loosely based on Henry Miller. And, you know, I'd read a lot of Henry Miller, but also knowing these guys who are, you know, gigantic egos, wine, women, song, Paris, me, and be able to write from that guy's point of view was so liberating and so thrilling and so much fun. Because, you know, part of it was, there are like seven different voices in the novel, and I hope it's clear none of them are me. So I just got to be a kind of multiple, really, going into my study every day, and, you know, which person was I going to be today? And none of them were remotely like myself.
This novel is told from so many different points of view. Lionel Main, that very self-important writer, a baroness, an art patron, an artist model, photographer, nightclub owner. But the two women who are the subjects of the photo never speak for themselves, which is so interesting. Were you ever tempted by that?
I tried. You know, the thing is, because Lou Villar, the athlete, later spy, is such a complicated character, she was the most difficult to write. And I tried everything. I tried first person, I tried second person, I tried letters, I tried this, I tried that. And everyone else was working like a dream. Everyone else was easy. And she was really tough. And part of it was that, you know, the mystery of her character really is the central mystery of the book. I mean, how someone who starts off as a child, really, I mean, an unloved but not at all evil child, just an unfortunate child, and has a series of bad luck, good luck events as a young woman, and then, you know, things happen to her and she becomes the person she is. Because that mystery remained so mysterious, and because I thought, finally, it just is mysterious. There's no solution to this. There's no easy answer as to why someone becomes this kind of person. The only way it worked for me was to write it as a kind of faux biography by someone else, a French biographer writing in, you know, our own time. And it was partly because the only real information I had about her in depth was a French biography written in the 70s, in which you just couldn't tell what was real, what was made up, you know, because it was full of, she probably thought, she would have thought, all dialogue, this person wasn't there. So I just invented this biographer, and suddenly it became easy because I just passed the problems along. My problems with the character became the biographer's problems. And also because of the character of the biographer, who became a character herself, who was quite neurotic. So the darker the story got and the more mysterious, and the more, she just couldn't stop talking about her own problems,
right.
Which was so much weird fun for me and such a way to kind of get at that mystery without having to confront it headlong.
The other thing I think that's so interesting, and I think this is to your immense credit, is that you make us feel the lure of the recklessness of that period, that attraction of the forbidden, that attraction of the danger. And that's kind of a fine line to write in a book like this.
Well, suddenly someone, you know, the 20s happened. I mean, I'm glad you asked that, Susan. No one has asked me that before. And actually, I hadn't thought about that until this moment. But, you know, I mean, I've been saying that there are things in the book that even though no one would ever in a million years imagine had anything to do with my life, I mean, there are ways in which the 20s were similar to the 60s when I grew up. You know, that sudden feeling of the last generation or the last decade, that is over, and the stops have been pulled, and the Edwardian Victorian times had ended, and in my case, the 50s were over, and suddenly you could reinvent yourself and make a new life and challenge the things you'd always been taught and have a kind of separate, exciting life and a different identity, that those were very similar times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I so agree. There's this wonderful paragraph when the Baroness Lily is speaking in the book, and I just want people to hear it. If there is an afterlife, I hope they will throw a party for the angels who on Earth were subjects of famous photos. There will be a carousel for those tragic little girls who sat for Lewis Carroll, nourishing meals for the Dust Bowl families. The lovers Gabor shot in cafes can devour each other forever. We'll visit with Baudelaire and Bernhardt, courtesy of Nadar, and with that funny Lartigue lady wearing more fur than her dogs. No need to invite Lou Villar and Arlette, who will be in hell.
You read that beautifully. You know, it's so funny. I've been thinking about what I'm going to read because I'm, you know, about to go on tour. And amazingly, that passage and the sort of part of that chapter is what I decided would be the easiest thing for all kinds of reasons. So there we go.
I love this book because it's an adventure in reading. You're just totally captivated by it the whole time you're reading it.
Oh, thank you so much.
It was
thank you so much.
A strange vacation. And fast cars, beautiful women, all the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with Francine Prose, whose fabulous new novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932. You can meet her Monday, May 19th at 7, when she reads from her work in an event sponsored by Room 220 at Press Street Headquarters, 3718 St. Cloud Avenue. Thank you so much, Francine.
Thank you, Susan. It was a real pleasure.
Edmund White is one of those writing virtuosos who does it all. Novels, memoirs, criticism, biography, you name it. And he's been duly recognized for those talents, winning a National Book Critics Circle Award for his biography of Jean Genet and several Lambda Literary Awards. He's well known for that autobiographical novel, A Boy's Own Story, as well as his Remembrances of the City of Light, The Flaneur, and Our Paris. He was one of the original seven members of the important gay writers group, The Violet Quill, and he is the co-author of the best-selling and groundbreaking Joy of Gay Sex. We'll be talking with him about his upcoming appearance at the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival this week and his new book, Inside a Pearl, My Paris Years. Edmund White, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that nice introduction.
Now, when you look back on such a fascinating period of your life, as you did in Inside a Pearl, going back to your time in Paris in the 80s, is it with longing? You make it seem so fresh. It doesn't seem laden with nostalgia or anything.
I guess it seems so recent to me, even though it's decades away now. But I guess partly because I stay in touch through email with tons of French people, or they come here and visit me. But I mean, Paris is still very much part of my life.
And you seem so sweet about your younger self.
Well, there are people who would disagree with you. But it's strange to talk about a formative period in your life after you're age 43. But one of the great advantages of uprooting yourself and moving to a different culture, a different language, a different world, is that you do get to start all over again. I mean, I had lived in New York from 1962 until 1982, so for 20 years. And I thought I could either go on and do this the rest of my life, teach, hang out with the same writers and stuff, or I could just start all over again. And, of course, the precipitating factor was AIDS. I mean, I guess I was hoping to go on an AIDS holiday in France, but, of course, it caught up with me right away.
Of course, sadly. But, oh, when you write a book like this, do you ever just sit back and think, well, you know, I did it? Because it was always your ambition to get to places like Paris and New York and know everyone worth knowing, and you've done that.
I mean, it oftentimes feels at the time like you're very marginal, but one of the advantages of outliving everybody is that you can give your version of things in which you seem to have played a major part.
Now, for you, writing and activism have always gone hand in hand, not just with writing The Joy of Gay Sex, but you are also the founder of the Gay Men's Health Alliance, which has been so important in educating people about HIV/AIDS. How has that worked for you? I mean, you've always seemed to feel that some of your writing should carry weight beyond the mere pleasure of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think if you're a minority writer, let's say whether you're black or gay or Asian, you're aware that your work is going to be taken as somehow representative, even if you don't intend it that way. So you're constantly aware of a political dimension to your writing. And then it just somehow spilled over that I played somewhat of a role compared to real heroes like Larry Kramer. my role was pretty insignificant. But, I mean, I was the first president of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and I was at the Stonewall Uprising. And probably the most significant thing I did was, I think I was the first well-known person who came out as HIV positive in 1985 without being symptomatic. I mean, in other words, I wasn't sick, but I had just discovered that I was positive. That's when they first started having those tests that could tell you that. And I made a big fuss about it because it seemed to me like it was a new way to come out as somebody positive. And luckily, I turned out to be what they call a slow progressor, somebody whose numbers do start to drop, but very, very, very slowly. So that by the time mine became dangerously low, the new medications had kicked in, and I'm still here, as they say in that song.
Oh, you are very much still here. Now, you've also said that at the very beginning, when you were part of that really important gay writers group, the Violet Quill, and you'll be with Felice Picano and Andrew Holleran at Saints and Sinners, who were also part of that, and you've said at the beginning you felt that you all had to be especially good writers, especially literary writers, to kind of lift beyond the ordinary.
Well, I think a lot of older people, I mean, there were people older even than us, and they always thought of gay writing as pornographic writing. And I think we wanted to redefine it as literary writing. And I think we felt that kind of pressure that minority groups always feel. I mean, that it's crazy to call women minority since they're majority. But, I mean, the writers like Virginia Woolf felt this extra pressure to be good writers, to write really well, to prove that they could do it. And I think that a lot of the early gay writers, I mean, the Violet Quill crowd, was also very eager to show their stuff. I mean, like Andrew Holleran's Dancer from the Dance, which I think is one of the great novels in English. And, you know, I think that we really struggled to make our mark. The other guys were products of Harvard and the University of Iowa writing program, which are the two probably best things of that sort in America. And I just went to the University of Michigan, but, you know, I was inspired by them.
Mm-hmm. And you're known especially for writing well about sex, writing beautifully about sex. Is that fun for you? Are those the fun parts?
I like to do it. I mean, it seems to me fairly rare, actually, because I try not to write pornographically, which has to be very formulaic, because people get irritated if they're doing one-handed reading and they want it to have the desired effect as a kind of marital aid, that they get irritated if the writing is too fussy or complicated. But I don't try to write that way about sex. I try to write realistically what actually goes on through your head when you have sex, which is usually comic. I mean, if comedy is defined as the body failing the spirit. And
well, that's a good definition, I think.
So I try to write about it realistically, but I have a very, I guess, lyrical appreciation of the body. So it's always fun for me to mentally take notes that I think I'll use later in my writing.
Now, you've said quite often that you have no regular writing habits, that you know, when it's not going well, you don't see the point in sitting there and slogging away, which I find very comforting. So how do you find yourself writing? In great bursts of inspiration? Is that how it works for you?
No, I'm sort of like my mother once said to me, I see now how you write, because she spent a week with me observing me, and she said, you're like a little bird who's always going back and pecking at his seeds. I mean, I love to cook. I work at home, which is a terrible distraction because you have the internet, the phone, friends dropping in, packages being delivered. And I just sort of do it all and then just keep coming back and writing another sentence or two. So I don't know. I don't know what drives me on. I guess guilt and also poverty. I mean,
guilt and poverty, the two great movers, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, now your life in Paris has been a great muse for you, a great source for you, hasn't it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it was a whole new world that I discovered at age 43. And I don't think too many people have had that pleasure to just sink into a totally new world where they had to learn a new language, make new friends, But I was lucky because I had two very good friends before I arrived in Paris. And one of them is sort of the star of my book, Inside a Pearl. And that was Marie-Claude de Brunhoff, who had a literary salon and who introduced me to, quote-unquote, everybody.
Wow, she emerges as a truly great character in this book. It makes me so wish I'd known her. And going to this book is like going to this fabulous party that just goes on and on and on.
So, well, I'm glad you see it that way. That's very generous.
Well, we've been talking with Edmund White, whose most recent book is Inside a Pearl, My Paris Years. You can meet him this weekend at the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival at the Hotel Monteleone. Check out sasfest.org for the complete schedule. Edmund White, it's been an honor. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
There are a few books, like the I Ching, where you can open them at random to any page at all and find something charming or useful or thought-provoking. It's a testament to Garrison Keillor's The Keillor Reader, the thoughtfully chosen anthology drawing from a long and productive writing career, that is just such a book. On one page, there's a story of his stroke, which offers the hard-won wisdom that comes with such a health crisis. On another, you might find a poem about Billy the Kid, or Keillor's version of Casey at the Bat. But it's hard, no, it's impossible, to read this book without feeling the corners of your mouth crinkle upward and your heart surge happily onward. It's a true gift to create a sense of home wherever you are, and that's exactly what he's done, for himself and for loyal listeners and readers. When I moved to New Orleans in the 80s, I was glad to find that Lake Wobegon, like Paris, was a movable feast. I learned to cook jambalaya and red beans and gumbo in my unfamiliar kitchen, heartened by the companionship of the Bunsens and the Krebsbachs and the Halversons. I'm a Larson, raised a Lutheran. These are my people, deep down. In the individual forewords to these essays, we learn a good bit about Keillor himself, his childhood in Anoka, Minnesota, growing up in a family of six children and his sanctified brethren parents, the invisible middle child in a family of eight, as he puts it. Everyone should have a cousin like Keillor's cousin Kate, if they can't have an Auntie Mame, that one wild relative who eggs us on and pushes us into the larger world. And everyone should find work they love as much and do as well as the inimitable Mr. Keillor does his. I especially love the way he describes writing his Prairie Home Companion monologues at the last minute, an adrenaline junkie like so many writers. Here are heartfelt meditations on the virtues and drawbacks of small-town life. The stories about Lutherans on a sinking pontoon boat in the middle of Lake Wobegon, or the adventures of Guy Noir, Private Eye. Here, too, are Keillor's stories about working at the New Yorker, his review of Mark Twain's autobiography, an obituary of his friend Chet Atkins, a speech to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 1999. And a meditation on the way reading a newspaper, just so, provided a fine sense of style. Keillor's work always combines gentle comedy with genuine affection and literary precision. The previously unpublished essay, Cheerfulness, is worth the price of the book. Keillor writes, "Cheerfulness is a great American virtue, found in Emerson, Whitman, Emily Dickinson, even in Mark Twain. Don't be held hostage by the past, the bonehead mistakes, the staggering losses, the betrayals of trust. Look ahead, improve the day, grow flowers, walk in the woods, be resilient, clear away the wreckage, and make spaghetti sauce. Power and influence are shadows, illusions. As Solomon said, the race is not to the big shots, nor the battle to the tall, nor success to a guy with connections." The Keillor Reader goes right to the funny bone, then to the heart. Dear God, what a lovely way to earn a living, he writes. And we, his grateful readers, couldn't agree more. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Novelist Joseph Boyden signs The Orenda, Tuesday, May 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Garrison Keillor signs The Keillor Reader, Tuesday, May 13th at 7:30 at Le Petit Theater. Tickets are available at Octavia Books or octaviabooks.com. Aaron Bowman, author of the dystopian young adult series Taken, discusses the second book in her series Frozen, Wednesday, May 14th, 3:30 at the Robert E. Smith branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Sarah Pekkanen signs Catching Air, Thursday, May 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Monty Dutton signs The Intangibles, Thursday, May 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Porter Shreve signs The End of the Book, Thursday, May 15th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Best-selling authors Kelly Armstrong and Melissa Marr discuss their work Thursday, May 15th at 4 at the Robert E. Smith branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Poet Peter Cooley signs his new book Night Bus to the Afterlife, Thursday, May 15th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Chelsea Handler signs You Gotta Be Kidding Me, Friday, May 16th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Tickets are available at the shop. Clifton Crace signs History Lessons, A Memoir of Madness, Memory, and the Brain, Friday, May 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Best-selling romance novelist Sabrina Jeffries will be the guest speaker Saturday, May 17th at 10 at the meeting of SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Julie LaManna signs her middle grade novel Upside Down in the Middle of Nowhere, Saturday, May 17th at 11 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans finishes up its year of David Copperfield with a discussion Saturday, May 17th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. The book for next year will be announced at this meeting. Author Kimberla Lawson-Roby, Latoya Smith, and Linda Duggins of Grand Central Publishing discussed the writing process, the publishing industry, and being an author in 2014, Saturday, May 17th at 3 at the Norman Mayer branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Robin Roberts signs her memoir, Everybody's Got Something, Sunday, May 18th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. K.L. Armstrong and M.A. Mars read from and sign Odin's Ravens, Sunday, May 18th at 1 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, May 18th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Francine Prose, reads from and signs Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, along with Michael Jeffrey Lee, author of Something in My Eye, at a happy hour salon Monday, May 19th from 6 to 9 at the Press Street headquarters, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Ellen Gilchrist signs her new story collection, Acts of God, Monday, May 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Edith Wolfe and Jeffrey Gibson take part in a conversation about Oswald De Andrade's Cannibalist Manifesto, Tuesday, May 20th from 5 to 6 at Ladder Library. That's part of the Prospect 3 Reads discussion series. Eve O. Schaub signs A Year of No Sugar, Tuesday, May 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Saints and Sinners, the literary festival for LGBT writers and friends, will be held at the Hotel Monteleone May 13th through 18th. There's a great roster of speakers, including Carol Anshaw, Greg Herron, Andrew Holleran, Felice Picano, and today's guest, Edmund White. For information, check out sasfest.org. Romantic Times is holding its annual conference here as well, May 14th through 18th at the Marriott on Canal Street. Watch for hundreds of romance writers, including E.L. James of 50 Shades of Grey fame. Check out rtconvention.com for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.